Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Beyond the Standard, the monthly online interview program sponsored by Christian Standard Magazine. This is Mark Taylor, publisher and editor of Christian Standard, and I'm really looking forward to today's discussion. Let me remind you that you can join our chat line to discuss what you're hearing with other listeners or to post a question that we can put before today's guest. Just log on as you're listening, and I'll be monitoring your comments during our program and try to get your question in front of today's special guest. I'm very happy today to welcome Dr. Mark Laser. Mark is the president and director of Faithful and True, a ministry called Faithful and True, and the host of the Men of Valor program, which is Faithful and True's online radio show. Dr. Laser is nationally recognized as a leading authority in the field of sexual addiction with over 27 years of recovery experience. Mark has written a dozen books on the subject of sexual addiction, including his groundbreaking book, Healing the Wounds of Sexual Addiction, and his three-book Men of Valor series. Dr. Laser lectures around the world and teaches at colleges, universities, religious organizations, and treatment centers every place. He holds a PhD from the University of Iowa and a divinity degree from Princeton Theological Seminary, and he's taken an hour out of his busy schedule to visit with us today. Dr. Laser, welcome. We're so pleased to have you with us this morning.
It's great to be with you, Mark, and I've enjoyed working with the Christian Standard, so it's a good relationship.
Yep. So 27 years is a long time, 27 years of recovery experience. And I'm wondering
right.
what your perspective, I wonder what your perspective on these issues is today as opposed to what might have been a couple of decades ago. What have you learned that's changed how you're helping people today, or is it just the same song sung over and over and over again? Before we dig into some of these other topics, I'd like to just hear a little reflection from you on where we are today compared to where we were when you first started this.
Well, I think, one of the main reflections about that, Mark, is that when I first got involved in the field, it was because I myself had crashed and burned. So, you know, I had struggled with my own addiction for 26 years, basically from age 11 to age 37. So, you know, I got intervened on it in 1987. And at that point, I already was an ordained pastor, was a PhD type in the counseling field. So I was a Christian counselor, a pastor, and I was, involved in, lots of different sexual activities. And by the grace of God, and I do underline the grace of God, I was intervened on by some people who knew where to get me some help. And so in 1987, I went to, at that point, the only inpatient treatment program for this addiction in the country. So, so when you ask me that question, when I first got involved 27 years ago, and I've been, I've been sober since that time. So, as my spirit and heart and mind has cleared up and gotten more purified, I think it's given me, greater perspective on the world out there. But in the early days, I was just focused on my own journey and getting what we call in the field sober, and then also for sure saving my marriage and my family. And we had three kids at that time, so those first several years were just really just a lot of energy devoted to my own healing journey. And definitely God, through the power of the Holy Spirit, was in all of that. And now, when I entered the field then again as a professional to do speaking, teaching, writing, counseling, what I've seen over the last 25 years is, just the massive explosion of sexual temptation, the depravity of our culture, the fact that the internet, which basically came into more popular usage in the mid-90s, has just exploded things in ways that we had never imagined before. So the long and the short of it is we are just up against it. I thank God every day, Mark, that I got into recovery in 1987 before the advent of the internet. the internet would have taken me down so many trails that I may not have survived.
Yeah, it's a pervasive problem for a lot of people. I want to begin at the beginning, Mark, and talk about this term sexual addiction.
Sure.
There are, obviously, you're a big advocate of the fact that such an addiction is real, it does exist. There are others out there saying that there really isn't such a thing as sexual addiction, that a lot of people, you know, do
right.
stuff sexually they maybe are ashamed of, but let's not put the addiction paradigm on that. What is your response to that? Or is anybody saying that anymore? Maybe the sexual addiction, the reality of it is pretty universally accepted. Where are we on that today?
Well, I think clinically, out in the medical community and in the counseling community and in the general clinical world, it's accepted. There are still some voices, even in the clinical world, that don't think it is. But as recently as about 3 weeks ago, one of our colleagues here in Minneapolis, John Piper, preached a rather strong sermon that there was no such thing as addiction. So, you know, there are a lot of Christian voices still out there that wonder about it. The way I look at it, Mark, is this, that one of the key terms that we use when we talk about any kind of an addiction, whether it's alcoholism or, you know, eating disorder or gambling addiction, is the word unmanageable. And when I think about the word unmanageable, I always think about the words of St. Paul in Romans chapter 7, verse 15, when he talks about the good that he wants to do, he's not capable of doing, and the evil that he hates, you know, that's what he does. That's kind of a definition of unmanageability, and when he's talking about that, he's talking about the fact that he hasn't, at some level, fully surrendered. If he doesn't fully surrender his life to Christ, then there's going to be unmanageable things that he doesn't want to do that he does, and there's some stuff that he really wants to do that he can't do. And I, you know, whenever I teach about this, I just always ask men to think about, have you ever tried to start something positive and haven't been able to stay started? Or have you ever tried to stop something that's destructive and you haven't been able to stay stopped? So I look at that whole section that Paul is teaching in, you know, basically Romans chapter 6 through chapter 9, and it's about the law of sin and death, which takes us back to the Garden of Eden. It takes us back to original sin, that God has given us free will, and because we have free will, we're going to make evil choices at times, and until we are fully surrendered to Christ, that is really an unmanageable thing. You know, we're driven by our selfishness, our greed, our rebellion, and all of that. And I think there's everything about a definition of addiction that's about selfishness, greed, rebellion, trying to control our own life, not being able to trust, not being able to surrender. So when I think about how we define addiction, I think about it as an original sin problem. And it's totally consistent with every understanding that I have about, you know, biblical teaching. There are some neuroscientific components of addiction in which, you know, the brain does. God has designed the brain in such a way that it will get perhaps addicted to certain substances that we put into it. There are neurochemical substances that are the product even of just thinking about sex, so that I think the brain can also become dependent on some of those neurochemicals, we call them. And so even by that definition, I mean, I think, you know, the sexual addiction satisfies, you know, even a medical definition of what addiction is all about. And when you think about the fact that the brain can think about something sexual that's sinful, and then you remember Jesus teaching in Matthew 5 about even a man who lusts after another woman in his heart so much as commits adultery, the brain really, when a man thinks about having sex with a woman other than his wife, I mean, the brain is capable of producing neurochemicals to which the brain can become addicted. So To me, there's everything about a definition of addiction that is consistent with our biblical faith. So, and I could give long-winded answers to this, Mark, but that's the basic thing.
So I'm curious about, I wanted to talk about two things. First, in a second, I'll let you say a little bit more about this brain chemistry issue. From what I understand,
sure.
That is key to understanding this.
Okay.
I'm curious about your analysis of when a person has become an addict. In other words, and anyone will have an erotic thought now or then, whether it's whether it's aimed in the right direction or not. He may see a movie, he may, whatever, see an ad, whatever. So how do you help a person decide? There may be people listening to this who are saying, well, yeah, I've done some stuff I'm not too pleased about, but I'm not an addict. How do you help a person decide when they've crossed the line from just what we might call everyday lust to a true addiction?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. There are criteria for that. We basically say that if we've seen a pattern of this over the course of a person's life, and that pattern indicates that the activity level has escalated. So, in other words, let's say you have an occasional inappropriate sexual thought or fantasy, and that's once a month, once every other month, or even once a week. That might not be an addictive pattern, but if we see that level of thought life has progressed or escalated to the point where you're having these thoughts every day, all the time, we would say that that's an escalation and that's an indication of addiction. You could apply that to some things that, like, the normal adolescent gets involved with, from, being exposed to pornography. And these days, that's at earlier ages. But whenever you get exposed to pornography, or, of course, by the way, you and I didn't discuss whether or not it's okay to talk about the M word here on the air, but assuming it is, masturbation is something that the normal adolescent experiences at some point, 11, 12, 13. Let's say, that is something that you experience once a month or something like that. If, in fact, even over the course of your life, that pattern of looking at pornography and masturbating increases to a frequent activity, perhaps, daily, then we would say it's escalated to the point of being an addiction. We have men that come in that have had, one affair. They've crossed the flesh line and been sexual with another woman outside of marriage. We would not necessarily say that's an addiction. But on the other hand, if the man moves on and continues to see that woman and gets somewhat dependent on that relationship, or he moves on to have sex with other women, and even the frequency of that becomes more often, we would definitely say that that's an addiction. So one of the key things to remember is that sexual sin is not inherently equal to addiction. Addiction is perpetual, chronic, overwhelmingly frequent sexual sin.
Right, and I think that term you used, escalation, is a key here also, isn't it? The little I've read about addiction, for example, an alcoholic is able to hold more and more alcohol often, is able to hide his use of it while he continues to drink more and more. And I think that there's a similar pattern with this problem too, isn't there? Either in moving to different activities or seeking more and more in order to get that same chemical hit that he got the first time that he tried this. I don't know. Speaking in very rank layman terms here, but
yeah, you're right, and you're describing the neurochemical dynamic called neurochemical tolerance, and that means that with an alcoholic, more and more alcohol is going to be needed to achieve the same effect over time. The same would be true of a cocaine addict, a heroin addict, a nicotine addict. And some would say, and this is stepping on toes, caffeine. I mean, how many of us would say that the first time we drank a cup of coffee, it gave us such a buzz we could hardly stand it. But then now, how many people even listening out there drink 4, 5, 6 cups of coffee a day? That's a minor form of perhaps even an addiction pattern. And so, you know, to understand the fact that, let's say, gambling, and there's another one, you know, if that is an addiction, what is the neurochemical attached to gambling that makes it something that the brain is susceptible to developing a tolerance pattern? Well, the main neurochemical that's produced when you gamble is adrenaline. And, you know, you have the fear of losing money, you have the excitement of the casino, and it's all producing adrenaline, and you're going to need more and more adrenaline to achieve the same effect. I'd say a lot of the men that I deal with are adrenaline junkies. You know, they a lot of the pastors I work with, for example, they always complain about being overworked and overstressed, but there's a part of them that their brain has become dependent on the neurochemistry that stress produces, and the main agent there is also adrenaline. So but by the way, Mark, I think we should talk about the good news here, and that is that you know, while the brain is capable of developing neurochemical tolerance to substances, including the ones we ourselves produce inside our own heads, the brain is also capable of detoxifying itself and transforming itself. And we do know that healthy habits, healthy behaviors, change the brain. And Paul was right in Romans 12:2 when he said we can transform our brain. So there's good news here. There's hope. If you have any of these kind of what we call dependencies, it doesn't mean you have to live with them for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that is something that I wanted to talk to you about, because it seems to me that it's possible for some people to use the addiction paradigm as sort of an excuse, as sort of a cop-out. Well, yeah, I mean, I do that, because, I mean, what do you expect? I'm an addict, after all. And
right.
I suspect that you won't tolerate that from the people you're working with.
not for longer than about 1 second. No. We're always responsible for our own behaviors. You know, so, you know, even if you would say that you are in that unmanageable, neurochemically dependent place, you know, we are still responsible for making the choices necessary to get ourselves out of it. So every addict, you know, that I know that's in recovery and is healthy would never use the addiction as an excuse to justify sin. So that's the bottom line answer.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to clarify something else with you. The neurochemicals that are responsible for this kind of addiction, could you say a little bit more about those? Adrenaline is the gambling addict's problem, and the workaholic's problem. Is adrenaline the issue here with the sexual addict also, or are there other chemicals?
There are other chemicals too, but adrenaline is one of the earlier ones. So let's say that you're having some kind of very sexually stimulating thought. Adrenaline is going to be the agent throughout the body to prepare the body for increased level of physical activity or sexual activity. So your heart rate's going to go up, your blood pressure's going to go up, lots of other things are changing in your body to get you prepared to be sexual, and adrenaline is the agent of that. There's another neurochemical a lot of people are familiar with and have heard of called dopamine. Dopamine is the reward chemical in the brain that gives us a sense of pleasure. So adrenaline in combination with dopamine, which can be experienced even if you're just thinking about sex, that's oftentimes been compared in terms of the part of the brain that it stimulates, the pleasure center of the brain. It's been compared to cocaine. Another neurochemical that's produced is oxytocin, and oxytocin is the the brain chemical that's produced when we touch skin to skin. Babies, if they don't get enough touch, being held and being nurtured through physical touch, they will have a condition which is commonly called failure to thrive, and they will stop growing, and in some extreme cases, they can even die. Oxytocin is a neurochemical God's put in the brain to give us a sense of connection and bonding and to relax us and so forth. And the effect of oxytocin on the brain has oftentimes been compared to marijuana. I think, you know, when you think about touch, therefore, I don't think we ever outgrow our need for touch. Even after, you know, we get out of being babies and toddlers, I think we all need a certain amount of human touch to give us a sense of connection, community, well-being. That can mean a handshake, a pat on the back, a hug, you know, those kinds of things. Then finally, if we get to the culmination of the sexual arousal cycle, which is, you know, the orgasmic experience, there's a set of neurochemicals released in the brain. They're technically called the catecholamines. One of them involved in that is serotonin, which we know has a huge mood elevation quality to the brain. And the effect of that combination of neurochemicals to the pleasure center of the brain has been compared to heroin. So when you look at the full sexual arousal cycle from thought life through touching, touching of yourself or others, to, you know, the ultimate part of that, the orgasm, you know, it's a really powerful neurochemical cocktail. So we basically say, Mark, that the average sex addict is, in fact, a drug addict.
Yeah, because it seems to me like that is a cocktail. That's a combination that is more potent and contains more elements than those present in almost any other kind of addiction. Am I hearing you right on that?
That you're hearing me right. And it's a dangerous thing, you know, to talk about, because, you know, there again, people are going to say, well, you know, are you saying that this is the hardest one to recover from? Are you being a little bit even arrogant about this? And of course, the one that you mentioned earlier, are you just using this neurochemical cocktail as an excuse to justify sin? The simple fact of it is that, you know, we know it's a very difficult addiction to recover from, because you don't need to go to a liquor store. You don't need to find some dealer on the street to get the supply of your drug. I mean, all you need to do is think about something. And having said that, you know, we also know that it's quite possible to detoxify from all of this and to lead a normal life.
Well, maybe we should move to that. Let's take 5 or 10 minutes to talk about something else first, and then we'll, because we certainly want to move to the how to detoxify part of this discussion. Perhaps we should talk about pornography in particular. You wrote about that in our February issue of Christian Standard, and I know that we've heard all kinds of statistics about the pervasiveness of pornography. It's so readily available on every computer. I think I read someplace that it's there's a huge percentage of all internet activity that is connected with pornography. We've read statistics about the high percentage of men and now sometimes women who have viewed pornography. And I dare say that there's probably very few who would listen to this interview who haven't at least viewed pornography once or come across it on occasion. So maybe you've already answered this question. Maybe it's an issue of escalation and the frequency and dependency and all of that. Does a person who's seen pornography have to worry about being an addict? Or do you feel like those who are using pornography regularly probably realize it if they'll just admit it, that they really are addicts? Anything in particular relating to pornography use on the internet that relates to this threshold of the user to addict? Or have we already covered that?
Well, we have in a way, but we haven't. I think that one of the powerful things to realize about the internet is that the internet is a major league, what we would call escalator. So back in my day, when I was 11, 12 years old, you know, I had to bicycle all over. My dad was a pastor in St. Louis at that point. You know, I had to really work hard at finding pornography. So these days, you don't have to work hard at all. I mean, now that's one thing. The other thing is that the internet has so much stuff on it that not only is it easy to find, but it's easy to, you know, move on to even more and more graphic or perverse material. So it's an escalator. We can progress. If you'll remember that part of the definition is, you know, is the frequency of activity escalating? You know, the internet, you know, is the escalator. It can move us on to stuff that we never imagined. I've got one young man, for example, now he's 23 years old, and, you know, when he was 16 or 17, he started looking at the internet, and, you know, it was basic, you know, pornography at that point, you know, naked women. You know, then he moved on to naked women having sex. Then he moved on to videos. Then eventually there was something that popped up about, you know, young women, which turned out to be underage women. And he's not oriented to young women. He's fully oriented to adult women. But the danger or the excitement, the adrenaline-filled nature of looking at something that was forbidden and obviously illegal, you know, led him into the escalation to looking at underage or child pornography. He was eventually arrested and so forth for that. But the important point there in terms of the internet is that, you know, the left on his own, he wouldn't have, you know, in the old days, he wouldn't have, you know, gone to, you know, the various seedy places that you would have had to go to get this kind of pornography. The internet, you know, brought it into his own home, you know, brought it to his laptop, brought it to his smartphone, and, you know, the escalator was there. We say that, you know, the internet is the crack cocaine of sexual addiction, and basically what that means is that it has the ability to hook people in much faster than anything we've historically seen.
Yeah, and the article that you wrote in Christian Standard was specifically about the problem of ministers in pornography, and it seems to me that I've read perhaps in that article or perhaps in other places that ministers are particularly vulnerable to this, or committed Christians are particularly vulnerable to a pornography addiction. Am I remembering that right? And if so, why is that true?
Well, yes, and, you know, this gets into a very large issue about what the role of the church is in the solution, but maybe we'll get to that in a minute. There have been a number of studies which have shown quite definitively that people who have been raised in evangelical homes, rigidly religious homes, are much more vulnerable to addictions of all kinds, and certainly sexual addiction. When it comes to sexual addiction, if you remember that one of the neurochemical agents here is adrenaline, and let's say a kid has been raised in a Christian home in which he's been taught, never do this, don't look at that, it's evil, it's awful, it's terrible. And one day on his computer at college, this kid, something pops up, and you know what takes over in the brain is that this is forbidden, this is dangerous, this is something I'm not supposed to do, and the adrenaline of that can be very enticing. When it comes to ministry, so you have a bunch of guys that are overworked and underpaid, and, you know, they are sacrificing and serving and doing lots of stuff. I think that dynamic makes them more vulnerable to one of the rationales that can be used to cross these lines. And that rationale is what we generally refer to as entitlement. I'm working hard. I'm serving the Lord. I'm doing all of this stuff. I'm exhausted. I'm burned out. I'm whatever. I deserve a break today. And I'm just going to, you know, look at a little porn here, and it's no big deal. It's just pictures and all of that. And that's, you know, that's one of the dynamics there, that, you know, the stress component, the entitlement component, you know, make ministers very vulnerable. But I also think, and one of the things I think I said in the article was that if you were Satan and you wanted to bring down God's good work, and, you know, in other words, the church, you know, who would you attack first? And so I think, you know, pastors are incredibly vulnerable to satanic attack. And now, and then another dynamic, which is, you know, we know that, you know, if moral failure is going to get you kicked out of the church and going to perhaps even cause you to lose your ministry. So, you know, that dynamic of fear is a lot of what prevents ministers from talking even to each other about these problems. And so, you know, they don't tend to historically reach out for help because they're afraid of the professional consequences. And so they remain in silence. And, you know, they also think, well, I'm a pastor. With God's help, I should be able to get myself out of this. And that can be very dangerous if you're not able to reach out for the help that we all needed. And I, by the way, I was a good example of that one. You know, I knew I had a problem for years, but I didn't feel confident enough that I could talk to anybody about this without, you know, really drastic consequences.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, because we've seen that happening here and there. I want to pick up on something you said just a second ago, and that is that people who've been raised in rigidly religious homes are more vulnerable to any kinds of addiction. So
right.
If I'm a parent of 6, 8, 10, 12-year-old kids, boys or girls, but especially boys, what can I do to, what should my attitude, my demeanor be to protect my kids from setting themselves up for these kinds of problems? I think a lot of conservative religious people would choose to become even more rigid, more protective. You can't do this, you can't do that. Oh, that's don't ever look at that, whatever, whatever. And
right.
It seems to me you're saying that doesn't work. So what does work?
Conversation. That's my immediate response to that. There's been also studies that suggest that, you know, parents who take the time to have conversations with their kids about sexuality and about God's plan for healthy sexuality, God's vision for marriage, God's plan for marriage. Interestingly enough, you know, we have the old stereotype that a father takes a son out for the talk, you know.
Right.
He's 12 or 13, and
right.
It's time for the talk. I'm going through a period of time where some of the men that I'm working with, their fathers took them out on a road trip and plugged in the cassette tapes of Dr. Dobson talking about preparing for adolescence. And that was the only time that Dad talked about sex with them. I will get sad if I think about this long enough, but the average man that I work with longs for, even as adults, healthier conversations with his father or with men about healthy sexuality, a plan for healthy sexuality, a plan of accountability. They just feel like, you know, they were neglected by their father, they were neglected by youth pastors, they were neglected by, you know, any kind of healthy teaching in the church about this. Strangely enough, the stereotype of fathers talk to sons and mothers talk to daughters, I think parents, you know, mom and dad, you know, ought to be able to sit down and have a conversation with a child, either a, you know, son or daughter. For example, if you're raising a son, I think it's really important series of conversations for, you know, a mom to talk to a son about women and, you know, how to honor women, how to you know, treat them with respect, and, you know, what is involved in all of this pornography stuff in terms of how it's degrading and all this kind of stuff. I do know that, you know, the people who have conversations, not just one, but an ongoing series of conversations with their kids those are the kids that are a lot less vulnerable. So it's much more important to talk to your kids than it is to lock down the computers and all that kind of stuff. Teach them, you know, how to make healthy choices based on a more honest idea of what God's plan for marriage is all about. You know, whenever I talk on college campuses, I talk to the kids about, you know, what is God's plan for marriage? Why would he want us to wait until marriage to have sex? You know, what is that all about? And try to give them a sense of vision for what that might mean, a sense of sacramental sexuality. Kids are not learning from the church the concept of sacred or sacramental sexuality, which means that it should be the expression of the one flesh union and the sacrament of marriage. So the sacrament of marriage means that Christ must be in it. There's everything about sex that should be a reflection of the spiritual connection of a husband and wife. Even the word in the Old Testament that's used for sex means to know. Adam knew Eve. And that word in Hebrew, yadah, is one that's used in the book of Psalms to talk about knowing God. There's, you know, in other words, when we have sex with our wives, we are to know them, and we are to know them spiritually and emotionally, and sex is an expression of that. So we've got to teach our kids that there is something to look forward to which cannot be imitated by pure biological sexuality. You can have all kinds of biological sexuality, and it will never be satisfying. The only kind of satisfying sexuality is one flesh connected spiritual sexuality. By the way, I'm now into my talk on sacramental sexuality, so stop me, Mark, and I'll. But I'm just saying we need to be proactive with our kids, very proactive with our kids.
Yeah, and it strikes me that it, that the conversation should be much broader than just here's what's wrong, here's what you shouldn't do, here's what's bad. Even some of the things that you've said that we should talk about, you can be degrading to women, and oh, look at that TV, look what we just saw on TV, that's so degrading to women. Look at that commercial, look how it's using women as sex objects. I mean, I think those kinds of things are good, but right. I think to be positive and even funny about the good gift that God has given us in sexuality as a part of, just like you might talk about, almost like you might talk about the weather or whatever. Yeah. Do you think, am I on the right track there?
Yeah, you're definitely on the right track there. I mean, it's for some Christian parents, it seems counterintuitive. I mean, they might think that the more I talk to a kid, the more likely he is to be sexual, when all research that I've ever seen indicates quite the opposite. The more you talk to kids about sexuality, the less likely they are to experiment with it.
Yeah. Some would say, and this take us off on a dog leg here, some would say that's why there's maybe less alcoholism in countries where alcohol is just a part of the normal everyday life. It's not this big
exactly.
forbidden thing.
That's
that you
a
have
great
to...
analogy. That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. So now that doesn't mean that you expose your kids to sexual activity, you know, masturbation or
right.
whatever. It's just you basically are treating it like a topic that can be discussed and talked about. It's normal to do so. It's normal to think about it. You know, I think if, you know, fathers would just take the time to normalize with their sons how natural it is to think these thoughts about women and so forth, and to also teach them about a positive reason for waiting, you know, waiting for sexuality.
Yeah.
And by the way, women are getting
so,
involved in this in massive amounts of numbers, so it's inherently important for parents to be talking to our young girls because, you know, the amount of stuff that's going on out there is mind-blowing. The young girls, even as early as 11, 12, and 13, who are sexting naked pictures of themselves, is an epidemic. It is just an epidemic. The 50 Shades of Grey movie, why did that make $80 million on its first weekend depicting the degradation of women to the point of bondage. I mean, where is that coming from? We've got a massive amount of work to do with our young girls because they're getting led right down the wrong path.
Yeah. Yeah. And the solution, in a nutshell, is not to put the clamps down on things, but to just open it up and understand the positive side of it. But I have a hunch that there's a lot of Christians in their own marriages who may have not wandered outside of the bounds sexually, whose own sexuality is rather repressed, and that if they feel that sex is something that's just something that has to be tolerated or whatever. And they really can't speak to the positive message that you're suggesting because they're the victim of their own upbringing.
That is exactly right. I mean, all the couples that we work with, they do experience sexual dysfunctions, problems, or at the very least that sex has kind of grown old and boring. And I will guarantee you that spiritual sexuality is not boring. So we have a lot of work to do with couples. First of all, to get them talking about problems that may have originated, in fact, on the honeymoon. You take a couple, for example, that has been brought up in that rigidity, and they've been told not to have sex, not to even kiss. In fact, that book, Kiss Dating Goodbye, that was popular a number of years ago, that did a number a lot of our young people. And they believe that their first kiss should be, the kiss that they do at the wedding ceremony. And so, they've had absolutely no physical experience whatsoever. They've had no conversation. They've avoided the subject. And then now all of a sudden we go off on the honeymoon and expect to go from 0 to 60 in one night. And, the massive amounts of difficulties, troubles, dysfunctions, and then now who do they talk to? There are some books in the Christian community that are out there that can be very helpful in those situations. But the key to it is that, there needs to be a lot more preparation, a lot more conversation, and a lot more openness to these things, because there are a lot of couples there that are living with a great deal of sexual frustration and shame, and it doesn't need to be that way.
That's very helpful. Well, let's talk about two things. You can do these all at once, or you can segment them according to what you know is best. There's two issues here that we need to talk about before we're done. One is, what can the church do to help their members who are sitting in the pews and who are either full-blown sexual addicts or they're on the brink of sexual addiction? What can the church do? And then secondly, here I am listening to your program, and I think that I probably qualify for the diagnosis that you're giving. What can I do? So you can talk about those one after the other, or maybe it's one answer to both questions, Dr. Laser.
Well, the one is about the church, and that's one of my favorite topics. In fact, as we're talking here, Mark, I'm 64 years old. I'll be 65 here in a couple of months. And in this season of my life, God has given our ministry a vision of going more directly and more often into local churches and putting on events, seminars, workshops, either for men, women, couples, in which we directly talk about these things and open up the subject. So I think, the church at all levels of ministry, from the youth ministry to couples ministries to men's ministry, women's ministries, Bible studies, small groups, I think we need to be introducing the topic. We need to be talking about this, opening up the conversation. I would even be so daring as to suggest that pastors preach a sermon series on this. I'm seeing it done more often in the last 5 to 10 years than I would have seen 25, 30 years ago. So it's starting to happen. But I do think that, the average couple sitting out there or the average person sitting out there in the pew or in the kid in youth group or whatever has a ton of questions, a ton of thoughts, a ton of stuff going on, and they just need somebody to open up the conversation. That can involve people who have struggled with this and found a way out, found victory, found purity, giving testimonies. I think there's nothing quite like even in various church settings, seminars, workshops, you know, people telling their testimony of, you know, what it's been like to struggle with this and what it's been like to find a way out. I'm all about, you know, pastors and developing, you know, sermon series and that kind of stuff. So I was talking to a youth pastor yesterday and who does the ninth grade youth group, and I, you know, have you talked about, you know, some of this stuff with your ninth graders? And she was saying, well, not really. You know, we got to change that. So I could talk about this one for, you know, an entire morning. Now, the guy that might be listening to this show who is struggling, I think the main thing to think about there is to what we call break the silence. The greatest enemy of sexual health is silence. And so, you know, I would just ask that man or that woman to think about how long they've been living in silence with these issues, out of shame, you know, with the thought that, you know, if I talk about this stuff, I'm going to be rejected and, you know, kicked out of the church and all this kind of stuff. And I would just reach out to one of the various ministries that's out there. You might start with your pastor and just say, you know, or one of your pastors, do you know of any local resources, counseling centers, support groups? There's a growing number of Christ-centered support groups at churches that are dealing with this. But the key principle there is make contact with somebody. And I know at some point you're going to list our website or whatever, and at the very least...
Go ahead and do that now, Mark.
Our website is faithfulandtrue.com. So it's all spelled out, faithfulandtrue.com. And there's books, resources, there's articles, all of our radio podcasts are archived there. So, you know, you can listen to me teach about a variety of subjects. And then we're also going to probably strongly suggest that you, you know, get some help, go to a 3-day workshop like the one we do. If you really think you're struggling with addiction, then, you know, you really need to get some help. You're going to need community. You're going to need accountability with other men or women. And, you know, there are things on our website that might direct you to that. And I'll be honest, there are a growing number of Christian ministries that are getting into this. We also have some of the other websites listed. If you happen to be listening to the show in the Phoenix area today, we're going to be at a church in Phoenix this Saturday morning doing a 4-hour kind of men's prayer breakfast type of an event from 8 to 12, and come and listen and meet other men from your area that might be struggling with this, and not just struggling with this. We're not just going to be talking about addiction. We're going to be talking about sexual purity. So, you know, you might want to go to our website and look for the, right now I can't even bring to mind the name of the church. I'm just getting on the plane tomorrow and showing up. But I would encourage, the main point I've already said a number of times, you know, don't stay silent about this.
And can you probably can give some encouragement to Christian men who are afraid to break this barrier of silence. They're afraid that the world will crash in on them once they talk to somebody about it, but they did it anyway and that didn't happen. Is there some encouragement you could share there for people who are, you know, white-knuckling it and afraid to pick up the phone and talk to anybody?
Well, yeah.
The world's,
I mean,
not going to end for them.
That's right. I mean, if you look at my life, for example, I mean, when I was in my, you know, late 20s and 30s and my addiction was rapidly escalating, you know, I thought that my career in ministry would have been completely finished if anyone found out about these things. Well, people did find out about these things, and I did go off to treatment, and I did lose, you know, all ministry for a time, for a season, which is part of my correction, part of my rehabilitation and all of that. But God was faithful. Philippians 1:6, he who began a good work in you will be faithful to complete it. At this point in time, Mark, this is going to sound a little narcissistic, and I don't mean it to. I want to point the listeners to hope that God has a plan. God has a direction. God is not finished. So I crashed and burned sitting in a treatment center thinking that God is completely finished with me. Well, at this point in time, I have spoken in every 50 state of the 50 states and on all six continents where there's a population to hear it. So God has allowed me to write almost 20 books at this point. You know, and I've spoken in churches, some of the big churches all over the country. You know, and in my story of addiction and sexual sin is depraved. So, you know, when I think about it, you know, God sometimes is going to use your brokenness, you know, use your humility. I mean, don't you think there's enough biblical witness to this idea that God can use that stuff to perfect your character and turn you into the man or woman that God calls you to be? And when you find that purity, when you find that freedom, God is going to use it. I'll guarantee you, you better get out of his way because he's going to use it. So, you know, be of good courage, be of hope. I mean, take a very courageous step and get honest.
Okay, that's great. That's great, great encouragement. Well, I feel like we could talk for another hour, but our time here is just about up. I want to repeat to folks the resource that you have founded, faithfulandtrue.com. There's a lot of resources there. One thing I'm curious about in the last minutes here, occasionally there are some resources out there offering what they call online accountability. You can, once again, in secret, make some contact with somebody who will help you when you're dealing with this issue. I have a hunch that that is not as effective as the face-to-face help that you have experienced and that you would suggest. Do you have any comment on that at all?
Yeah, I do. And I want to be careful here because I do think that there are people living in remote and isolated places where, you know, they just don't have access to a lot of stuff. And in that case, you know, having an online community can be, you know, somewhat helpful. I'm thinking of a missionary, for example, in some far region of China, where the only access he had to any kind of face-to-face accountability was through the Skype community that he developed. But yes, you're right, Mark, that, you know, there is, in fact, no substitute for face-to-face, in-person accountability. And one of the books that I've written is about Seven Principles of Accountability. You can look at that on our website. And there's just so much more work to this. And by the way, I don't think you need to be an addict and to work an accountability program. I think, you know, living in our current culture, you know, I believe that our culture is sexually addicted. You know, you can look at all the criteria for addiction and say that, you know, the frequency of sexual stimuli is increasing. The amount of adrenalized activity that we need to get sexually stimulated is increasing. I mean, I always think in terms of the most recent examples. You know, I grew up watching the Academy Awards in the 50s. I cannot imagine Bob Hope coming out and hosting the Academy Awards in his underwear. But, you know, this past Sunday night, we had an actively open and gay man coming out in his underwear on a national level broadcast. I mean, so, you know, if we're living in a sexually addicted culture, then we all, whether we have experienced the full-blown nature of addiction or not, we better be in some level of accountability because, you know, sometimes we're just one step away from the pit that Satan through culture has created. And I would just encourage all the men and women out there to think about, you know, stepping up their levels of accountability, which basically means an honest ability to talk with others about all of this.
Yeah, I heard a counselor speak one time who said, you know, if we would confess more of our temptations to each other, we wouldn't have as many sins to confess to each other. And
that is exactly
I think that
right.
is a really, that's a profound right. statement. And I think that a lot of Christians are ashamed to even admit that they're tempted to do this or that. and whatever it might be. And we don't have settings in which people can really be honest.
Well, before
we leave today, I want to remind readers that Dr. Laser's article on ministers and pornography appears in the February issue of Christian Standard, along with a whole treasure trove of related articles about how our churches can lift up godly sexuality and deal with the sexual problems and issues plaguing our society. You'll find most of those articles at our website, sprinkled on our website, christianstandard.com, but if you would prefer to have them in one neat package instead of just searching for them at our website, you can get that by taking a look at the digital edition of that February issue. Since last summer, we've been offering digital issues of Christian Standard, and many, many people are enjoying Christian Standard every month now on their smartphone or on their tablet. And you can find Dr. Laser's article and our whole February issue of Dealing with Sexuality there. You can download the app. It's free for your smartphone or your tablet, and it's available on virtually every format, the Apple App Store or Google Play for your Android phone, or among the Amazon apps for the Kindle Fire. The app is free. There's a lot of free material on there. But as well, then, you can purchase this individual issue of Christian Standard, or you can subscribe for a whole year and get it downloaded automatically to your phone every month for only $14.99, which is the price of, an inexpensive dinner someplace. So we really encourage you to search for Christian Standard at the App Store or Amazon Apps or Google Play, and to find this article by Dr. Laser, as well as a whole treasure trove of other resources. If you find the Christian Standard app for your device, you'll see that the March issue is already there, full of ideas from churches across the country that have done something special with their annual Easter celebrations, and I think many of you will want to read that issue as well. Now, before we sign off, let me tell you about next month's program. Mike Baker, who is president of the annual North American Christian Convention, will be my guest 4 weeks from today, March 26th, at the same time, 11 a.m. Eastern. Mike will not only describe and explain the program for this year's convention in June, but he'll also tell us what he's learning about Christian churches and churches of Christ in this year of leadership among this group of congregations. And we'll also prod him a little for some details about his own ministry with the megachurch he serves there in Normal, Illinois. We are so grateful to you, Dr. Laser, for taking time to talk with us today. I want to thank all our listeners, too, and remind you that this program will be available for you to download and share with other concerned leaders in your church. If you go to blogtalkradio.com/standardpublishing and scroll to the bottom and look at archived episodes, you'll see a whole slew. I think there's 20 or 30 episodes there archived and ready for you to listen to. And you can download them to your computer and then share them with people at staff meetings or other kinds of meetings that you're having. And I think this episode will be one that can help a lot of people. Get material helpful like this every month in Christian Standard, available in print, on the web, and for your smartphone or tablet. We're looking forward to continuing to serve you in the months ahead. And so until the next time, let me wish you well and simply say goodbye and God bless you.